Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about the functions XV6 uses internally to manage memory. We started by looking at one of the things we looked at was calloc and kfree. So one thing XV6 needs to do is it needs to choose a physical page to give to a program to allocate memory for the program, for heap, for the stack, to load its code into. And we saw that this is done with this function called calloc, which works in tandem with kfree. And this maintains a linked list of available pages that's set up at boot. And there's this trick as far as where do we store the actual like next and previous pointers, rather than allocating some sort of separate space for that. They're stored in the free pages themselves. Then we said, well, given that we have mechanisms to set page table entries and to choose physical page numbers, how do we allocate memory for a program? And we saw allocuvm was the function which did this, and it was a relatively straightforward loop that looked up a page number called and mapped that to a newly allocated physical page. And we saw that this kept track of the extent of the memory of the program with size. So this was the sort of end of the program's memory. And we saw that the program could trigger more memory to be allocated by increasing the size with the SBRK system call. So then we looked into this idea that instead of just having a program crash when it accesses memory we haven't allocated for it, we have other options. And one example is that we saw was allocate on demand. But in any of these examples, what we're going to do is we're just not going to set up the whole page table in advance. So for allocate on demand, that means we're going to tell the program, yeah, I allocated some space for you, and not actually do it. But on a page fault, we'll look up, well, what did we actually promise the program? So for allocate on demand, did we promise the program that we allocated this space? And if so, we'll update the page table at that time. And when we return from a page fault handler, the processor will, by default, just retry the instruction that was accessing the memory with no valid page table entry. So if we made a page table entry that makes it valid, when we return, it will work the second time, and the program will move on as if we had allocated the memory in advance for allocate on demand. And as if we had otherwise set up the page table entry sort of correctly in advance. So allocate on demand was our first example of this. The idea that, well, for something like the stack, we don't want to just have to set up the whole stack that the program might not use. And even for other types of memory, well, the program's not going to use the memory it allocates right away. So we can kind of speed things up a little bit by, just recording that, yeah, the program has that memory, and actually taking care of allocating that later. And mention that this is actually very commonly done by modern operating systems, that they'll not actually set up the whole page table in advance. They'll do it as they need to. So another thing we talked about was speeding up fork. So using the same kind of idea as allocated on demand, we're going to not actually do the operation of copying a program's pages when we tell the program we did. So when we return from fork, the notion is that, well, now there's two copies of of what was originally the parent process's memory. But what we can do instead is we can just mark both of those things read-only. And that means when someone tries to modify one of those copies, the operating system will run because there will be a page fault, a protection fault for accessing read-only memory and trying to write it. And at that point, the OS can figure out, okay, should that memory really be read-only? And figure out, no, it shouldn't. And make a copy at that time. And if the program only reads the memory, well, we don't actually need two copies. So this saves copies in the actually very common case where a program forks and doesn't actually change much of its memory before we can dispose of most of the process's memory. For example, if the process execs, we don't need that child process's memory anymore, though we still need the parent, of course. If the child is what it's exactly. And finally, we just barely introduced sort of a trick that's kind of an extension of this sort of copy and write and allocate on demand idea, which is making files appear as part of the program's memory. And this is something that's supported on POSIX systems, including Linux, with the mmap call. So this maps a file as part of your program's memory. And you mentioned that Linux actually kind of uses this as sort of how it organizes, how it manages a program's memory in general. That Linux just thinks of a program's memory as a list of mapped files. You might say, wait a moment, you know, the stack is not a, you know, doesn't correspond to a file. The heap doesn't correspond to a file. How does that work? Well, there's this just special case that this list of mapped files, some of those files can be a file with no name. And we also mentioned that this mmap call supports these two kind of ways of making the file appear as part of your memory. There's this shared way where it really looks like the file is in your memory. If you modify that part of your memory, you end up modifying the file, and vice versa. If someone else modifies the file, you'll see it in your memory. And there's this private mapping where if you modify the file, you get your own private copy, which means that in a typical implementation, some copy on write is going to happen here. So questions about these things we covered last time. So I see one, which we'll start with, and wait, see if I get more in the meanwhile. So one is copy on write doesn't copy everything when you write. So we can make a copy. We need to make a copy of the page the program was trying to write. So we need to copy the whole page because the only thing we can tell the processor is that this page is mapped to location A or location B. We can't do anything more fine-grained than that. But we don't have to copy, you know, all of the memory when the program writes the first time. We can just do it one page at a time. And if a program doesn't write a particular page, we don't need to copy any part of that page. And question, for allocate on demand, do you actually need to change the instruction pointer or return to a special value in the track instruction? So part of how processors support this idea of being able to fix up a page table entry and run the program again is by setting up when the trap handler runs, that if you return normally, it will go back to the instruction that triggered the trap. And this is deliberately different than what happens for example, for a system call trap, where when we return normally from a system call trap, it goes back, you know, immediately after the system call instruction. Instead, the processor has deliberately made a different choice just to make the OS easier to write. Other questions on allocate on demand, copy on write, or mmap. So the question is, when we're doing copy on write for fork, do we create another page table for the child? Yes. And the reason we're going to do that is that when the child writes, it's going to need different page table entries. But it's going to be the case that, second part of this question, that it maps to the physical address, same physical addresses as the parent? Yeah. So it's after forking, the page table of the parent and child for copy and write is going to look exactly the same. It's only when either the parent or child start writing that they're going to look different. That answer that question? Other questions? Okay. So last time we looked at this mmap call. So I mentioned that this lets us take a file at some particular location for some particular amount of stuff, part of our memory, and we can specify, in the program that calls this, whether we want to read, write, or execute that memory. And we can also specify whether the mapping should be shared, meaning that we see modifications to the file, and that when we modify the stuff in our memory, it modifies the file, or whether it should be private, meaning that we sort of get our own copy, which typically is actually going to be implemented with copy on write. And there's some more flags I'm not going to mention. I'm going to talk briefly about this adder field. So in all the code I'm going to show you, we're going to pass null for this. This is a suggestion about where to put the mapping. The OS typically ignores it or doesn't do much with it. So typically we're going to pass null. There's a special way of saying, no, I want you to choose this exact address. But that's not a feature that's used very frequently. So since we've looked at mmap, let's do this exercise, which I hope we didn't do last time. So here I have a use of mmap where we have a file hello.txt. We make three different mappings of it with slightly different setups for those permissions and the shared and private fields. So a question about mmap generally while we're looking at this. So why would we use this feature? So one reason we're going to use it is that this is actually how Linux loads programs. That if you think of loading a program, we're copying stuff from the executable file into memory. So the way Linux does that is that loading a program is translated into a bunch of mmap calls. So if you want another example, and maybe a reason why the shared mappings would be used, this is one way you can end up getting memory which is shared between two different processes, if you wanted to have processes communicate in that way. Kind of like you can have threads communicate. Oh, so a question. So someone's asking, why would the setting a specific address feature be used? So going back to the example of loading programs, it might be the case that the program you're loading, or say a library you're loading, expects to be loaded at a particular address. That adder field gives you the flexibility of saying, please load it at this address because the code expects that. That reasonable answer. Okay, I'll give another 5 seconds or so. So, I believe the right answer is D, and it seems like that's the majority answer, but a lot of you want it to be B. So something that I can use to eliminate B is that if I look at P3 here, it's set up with map shared. And that means that when the file is modified, that's going to be reflected in P3. So this means that our third string here has to actually reflect the real contents of the file. And the same is going to be true for buffer because we just read from the file. So the first and third thing in this output here, that's printf, needs to be the same. So that's how I can eliminate B. And it looks like those of you who selected B really wanted it to be the case that because we map P3 here, we got a copy at that time. But that's not how a shared mapping works. Shared mapping means that if the file changes, it changes what we have mapped. And as far as what happens, so P2 here is a private mapping. So we basically are going to have two different copies of the file. We're going to have the one that's being used by P3, P1, and read, which is initially foo, and the one that's being used by P2, which is initially also foo. And in P2's copy, we change the set character at index 2, which is the third one, because we're starting indexes at 0, C, to B. And in P1's copy, which is the same as P3's, and the one we're going to read later, we change the last two indexes to I and X. So question, is there a practical use here for mmap versus dupe to? So mmap is just, it's a way to read a file, is how I would think of it. So it's less of something that you'd use instead of dupe to and more of something that you'd use instead of like read or write. So the question, what happens if we try to write to P3? So since we told the operating system to give it read permissions and not write permissions, we would expect to get something like a seg fault if we tried to write to P3. And what would happen under the hood is the operating system would get a page fault. It would look up how it promised to let you access P3 and say, oh, I didn't promise to let you write to this. That's a crash. And the question is, so what if we tried to write P3 and I added prop write here, would it work? Yes, it would work, and it would modify the file the same way writing to P1 did, because it would actually be the same kind of mapping. And the question, if mmap is used to load a program, does it also have to allocate the stack and the heap separately? So when a program is typically loaded in Linux, there's basically something in the kernel which internally does something like calling mmap a bunch of times. It doesn't actually call mmap because it's inside the kernel, so it can't really make system calls there. If we were doing it by hand, we would probably need to make arrangements for the stack and heap to make sense. The heap is kind of actually a special case, because even though Linux tracks the heap as one of these mmap regions, it has an sbreak system call for historical reasons. So it has something like a size, like XV6 has, in addition to these map regions, just to support the historical idea of the heap growing like XV6 makes it grow. So the question is, why does buffer default to P1 and P3 and not P2? So buffer is reading from the file descriptor, which reads from the file on disk. And only P1 and P3 are not supposed to be private copies of the file. So a question, if in mmap, if I open with map private and edit my private mapping, how would I, you know, write the changes back to the file? You'd have to do something like make a write system call or copy it to a shared mapping, you know, just like you would if you like actually like allocated something with malloc and copied the file there. So a question is, a map shared side effect preventing the processor from, you know, reordering loads and stores? So no, but there's no concern about the loads and stores having inconsistent results here because we're all in one thread. So the processor is going to do the job of making it appear as it executes in the order we specify. So I mentioned that Linux manages a program as a list of maps. So here's, you know, we showed this briefly last time. This special file, if you load this file, proc self maps, it outputs the list of m maps that it thinks your process contains. If you do /proc and a PID, like, you know, 17 maps, it will give a particular process. And this is a table. I looked up in the documentation what the rows are. I don't think it's obvious. So columns are. So the first is the range of virtual addresses. And second column is the permissions. So in this case, this first mapping is this range of addresses and maps to bincat and is readable, executable, and private. Now the private here doesn't matter because it's not writable, but that's what, you know, was chosen when this program was loaded. And this is a mapping of the beginning of bincat. So this is how Linux decided to load the program, is that it set up this mapping and these next two mappings based on the instructions in the executable, you know, as private copies of the executable's data. So rather than, you know, actually copying all the data, it did this mmap call, which is going to do something kind of like allocate on demand to load the executable data. These columns here are information about the file. So Linux is outputting the file name, but that's not actually how it knows where the file is. This information is, we'll talk about what these fields mean, but there's a device major number, a device minor number, and an inode, which is what the file system uses to actually identify the file rather than this name. So this whole thing is basically equivalent to this mmap call, assuming that we actually use the adder field. And the way this is going to be implemented, or at least a possible way of doing it, is that, well, when we make that mmap call, or that's done sort of on our behalf as the program is loaded, the OS is going to record that, you know, there's this range of pages which should map to the file, but it doesn't actually need to update the page table at that time. We can just do this all on demand. And then as our program runs, we're going to try to access something. So like we read from, say, the second page, and that will trigger a page fault. And in this case, the OS happens to have the file data already loaded. So something we're going to see is that the operating system is going to keep parts of the file data in memory to speed things up, because we'd rather not load things from disk unless we really have to. So if it's already in memory, that page fault handler, it's not going to do anything fancy. It's just going to find the cache page and update the page table entry to point to it. Now, sometimes we're not going to be so lucky to already have it in memory. You know, maybe we didn't run bincat yet since booting, so there wasn't any reason to load it. In that case, the page fault handler is going to trigger loading the page from our disk, and then we'll do the same update we did before. So this is how we would load the file sort of on demand for that mapping. questions on what went on here. Now, when I gave my initial example, of that exercise, I showed you this shared mapping. And this is how it might look like in the proc PID maps output. Now, we didn't see that in this example I showed earlier from Bing Cat because, well, we typically don't map files as shared when we're loading a program. We typically want the program to have its own private copy because we're kind of using this mmap thing as a shortcut for actually having the program, have its stuff copied into memory when it starts. So the shared mapping, we have this S field here. So how does that work? Well, it's the same kind of idea. And the big trick that makes it work is that we're going to make sure that this cache copy of the file is also used by read and write system calls. And we're going to have to do a little extra tracking. So read's going to work the same way. When we do a write, we're going to need to somehow figure out that, we wrote to this part of the data. So one way we could do that is by setting it as read-only. And on a page fault, we say, let's make it writable. That's fine. And just record that a write happened here. Another way is that the processor actually will help us and set a page table entry flag when the write happens. But either way, we need to know that a write happened, so we know that the copy on disk is out of date. And when the program writes using that shared memory, we just need to make sure that the way read and write are implemented is that they're going to go to the same cache memory rather than going directly to disk. So we just need to do the bookkeeping to know that when we read from this file, first we check for a cache copy, and we make sure we use the cache copy, because the copy on disk might be out of date. And of course, we're not going to keep this copy in memory indefinitely. So eventually, we're going to free up this memory and write the update to disk. And we just need to do some bookkeeping to remember to do that. Questions on this, how this shared mapping works. Okay. So, BingCat also, looking at our example of loading a program, we have this part of it which is loaded read, write, and private. So this is probably where BingCat's global variables are, because we want to load the initial value of the global variables from the executable, but we want to allow the executable to run and change them. But we don't want those changes to actually change the executable. We want a fresh copy each time we start BingCat. So how does that work? Well, reads are going to work just like before in the typical case. But the issue is, what happens if we try to write? So let's say we have a global variable here, and the program tries to write to it. Well, we're going to get a fault, a page/protection fault. So I'll call page faults that are triggered by the permission bits being wrong protection faults. And our fault handler is going to realize, this is read-only, but I promised that the program could write to it and get its own private copy. So I'm going to make a private copy now. So we'll do the copy on write thing and give the program its own copy that's a copy that we're not going to actually write back to disk because it's a private copy only for the program. So this means that when the program writes to parts of the file, it will get for each page it writes to its sort of own copy of that modified data, which in this case would be copies of, the parts of its global variables that it has modified. Questions on how this copy on write sort of for private mappings looks. So question is, so the first example we saw is not copy on write and not shared. So the example I showed here, it was read only. So there was no notion of what happens on write because we crash on write. Other questions? Let's do this exercise. So here I have a situation where, let's say I have a mapping set up for foo.dat, which is copy on write, and I have part of the file cached in memory. And the program reads from part of this mapping and writes to part of this mapping. I'm asking, how many page faults do we expect to happen during this process? And I want you to assume that when a page fault happens, we only fill in that page. So something you might observe if you're thinking about how can we make this fast is that maybe the OS could try to be clever and, you know, and say, oh, if you're writing to the first page, maybe you also want the copy of the second page and do that in advance. Let's assume we don't do that, even though that is, in fact, a good idea. And something, if you're still thinking about this, that might be helpful is remember in XV6 that, you know, the bottom 12 bits are page offset and the top bits are our virtual page number. So we can separate out the virtual page numbers from these addresses. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so we have quite a spread, and the majority answer is 3. This is not the answer I got. And what I think, I think there's a different assumption for the answer 3. So how I did this is I said, okay, so we're accessing this range of addresses. So this is going to access VPN 0x13. It's going to access half of that page. Then VPN 0x14. Then VPN 0x15. And hopefully, you know, even though we're accessing, say, this page 13 multiple times, you know, the first time we're going to access it, we're going to have a page fault. And whatever we do to handle that page fault is going to make it so the second time we access it, say at address 13801 instead of 13800, that's going to work out. So that first access to this page 0x13, it's going to be at offset 3 in the file because this mapping, you know, 1013 is 3000 into the file, and that's already cached. So that is going to still need a page fault because we told you that the page table is filled in on demand only. So something you might have observed is maybe when we set up this mapping, the OS should have set this up in advance. It could have done that. An assumption of the question is that the OS didn't bother to do that. And there's a performance trade-off, right? If we set up all the mappings in advance and the program doesn't actually read from the whole file it mapped, well, we just wasted time. But if it does read, maybe it was faster because we avoided a page fault. And our assumption is that we've kind of chosen the first side of the trade-off in this question, even though, yes, it would be valid for the OS to choose the other side. So then we access page 0x14, and that's not already cached. So that's going to need a page fault to, and the page fault's going to read that in. And if our assumption is that we're doing this on demand, we don't actually know yet that the program is going to access the page 0x15, which is offset 0x5 in the file, 0x5000 in the file. So we're just going to bring in the first thing if we're doing things on demand only. So it's true that maybe we could guess that we need the next part and also read it. That would be a thing that real OSs do. Kind of an assumption of the question is that we're not making that assumption here, even though it is reasonable. So if we don't make that assumption, we have one page fault for 0x14 and one for 0x15. And on both of these, we need to read something in from disk and then set up the page table entry after that. So these are just reads. So at this point, our page table entries point to the shared cached version of the file. And when the program does these writes, this is going to write to two VPNs. So we're going to have some writes to half of virtual page 14 and a little bit of virtual page 15. And we're going to have to give the program an independent copy of each of these pages. And when we see the write to 14800, we don't know yet that the program is going to need its own copy of 15100. So, you know, if we're doing things only on demand, if we're not guessing about what the program is going to need, we're going to have one page fault to make a copy of this page and one page fault to make a copy of this page. So questions about my reasoning here? So the question is, does the cache only store the page offset? So in my explanation here, I'm giving the offset in the file to make it more consistent with my information about what parts of the file are cached, but there's lots of choices as far as what actually the bookkeeping would look like for the cache of the file. So this offset here, this is not a page offset. This is the location relative to the beginning of the file, to be clear. So. Question, the read from disk and set PTE counts as one page fault since it's all going to be handled in a single page fault? Yes. In particular, we can't return from the page fault that reads page 0x14 until after it's both loaded from disk and we've set the page table entry. If we try to return earlier, well, that's not useful because the program's just going to have another page fault because the page table entry is not set right. So the question is, what's the point in caching these addresses if we're going to fault in reading them? So the page fault for this first page fault is going to be way faster to handle than the second and third one. So like this first page fault like is going to be, you know, on the order of like, you know, this is going to be microseconds and this is going to be milliseconds most likely. So even though we're doing some work on the first read, it's still going to be way faster because it's cached. And notably, in both cases, we only have one fault per page. So even though we're reading 2 kilobytes from, say, this page here, this one fault, which takes probably around microseconds to handle. Other questions, follow-ups? Oh. And someone's pointing out that this page here is cached, and I misread my output here. So the 2 is milliseconds, the 3 is also, so both of these are this case, because we only set without reading, you know, so we use the cached version for the 5,000 index because, you know, that was also cached. Yes, and I misread my answer here. So in this case, so as a correction, we only need to read from disk for the 1-4 page. So this page needs to be read from disk. Read from disk, and the other ones are going to be cached in advance. Other questions? Thanks for pointing out that mistake of not reading my question carefully. Okay. So, looking through sort of more of the nmap output, so some other things. So you see this heap here. So I mentioned earlier briefly on Linux that the heap, there is actually an S-break system call on Linux, which works very similarly to how the system call works on XV6, but basically it gets translated into some funny mmap. And we can also see some mappings here that, like the heap, don't have a file associated with them, but aren't part of the heap. And this is something that happened as part of the program allocating memory for itself. So part of how malloc works on Linux is that sometimes malloc uses this heap, and sometimes it makes a memmap call like this, which, you know, allocates some space that's just not backed by a file. So let's look at how this sort of space that's like the heap, or this space allocated with mmap but with no actual file descriptor, how that looks. Well, it's the same idea. We have some data, and we don't have stuff on disk because there's no file. And yeah. So the way this works, though, is that, you know, we're going to actually allocate space on disk when we need it. So for example, let's say the OS needs more memory and we've allocated some space sort of on demand to the program's heap or some other sort of dynamically allocated region of memory with no actual file underneath. In this case, what the OS will do is it will say, okay, I'll just take some of that space and choose a place on disk for it. So even though there's no file, you know, sort of, you know, basically the OS makes up a file. And this is often known as swapping, that the data that was in memory is temporarily swapped out to free up some space in memory. And then later on, when the program actually tries to use this space, if there's a page fault there, it will be brought back into memory. And we can discard the copy on disk because there's no actual associated file. We don't need to keep it there, unlike our normal case of accessing, you know, something that, you know, is going to need to stay in the file in a shared mapping. So questions about this sort of swapping idea? And you can see that this swapping is kind of just the same as how we manage sort of shared pages in a file. It's just that there, you know, we only keep stuff in the file if we don't have a cached copy. and the file just doesn't have a name that you can make up. So questions, are the temp files on disk accessible outside the program? So commonly on Linux, they're stored in a part of disk that is either going to be called a swap file or a swap partition, which, yes, you could access if you have enough permission, but it's usually not in a format which is very usable. So another case where this idea of swapping data comes up comes with our copy-on-write idea. So let's think of our scenario earlier where I showed you having a copy-on-write mapping of a file where we've made it, you know, the program's modified a part of the map file, say, to write to a global variable, and here we have all the default values for our global variables. And let's say you want to free up space here. Well, probably the first thing the OS will do is it will remove the cache copy of the file. Why would we start with that? Well, we have a backup copy if we need it. So this is a quick way to free up space. But let's say we still want to free up some space after this. Well, we want to free this up. So what we'll do is we'll do the same trick we did for stuff with no location on disk, is that we'll assign a space on disk, we'll make up a file name for the private copy of this data, and we'll swap that out too. And the same idea will apply. If the program tries to access memory here on the page fault, we'll bring this back in. And similarly, if the program tries to access memory in some part where there wasn't a private copy, we'll bring in the, you know, original file on disk. And we have to, of course, do the bookkeeping to remember where do we have sort of a private copy of part of the file versus where can we just use the original. So questions on sort of how this swapping looks here and with this, when combined with this copy on write scenario? Okay, so something we're seeing here is that Linux and most Unix-like OSs kind of treat memory as a cache for disk, that really everything in memory has a place on disk. So this is obviously true for files, because, well, files are sort of primarily stored on disk, but we can see because we like choose locations to place data on disk, that really, you know, the sort of last resort location, the place where we're gonna, you know, where we can always store program memory is on disk. And this is true for no matter what type of program memory it is, we also can keep, always can keep it on disk when we need to. And this, when we look at things this way, one way we can view it is we can kind of think of it as files and program memory is, you know, it really belongs on disk, but to get performance that's reasonable, we just are temporarily keeping it in faster storage, and it sometimes happens that we never actually need to take it out of the faster storage. And in this view, we can kind of view physical memory as a cache for stuff that's on disk, and this includes both stuff that the program is accessing and files that we're just reading and writing, because we saw that, you know, that read and write are accessing these cached pages. And in fact, they kind of have to in order for shared mappings to work correctly. So this view of memory as a cache for disk commonly is called a page cache because we have a cache of pages that are stored on disk. And physical memory stuff is just, you know, a set of pages that, you know, are cached in memory, but really have their home on disk. You know, that's sort of their default location. We're just speeding things up by keeping them in memory. And we're going to talk about, well, if we're caching data from files and programs, how do we manage that intelligently? And this is often a very large part of how operating systems manage their virtual memory, is this logic for how what do I keep in memory versus what do I let stay on disk, how do I put things in memory, and so on. So we're going to look at how this diagram of sort of what are the components of our page cache. And I'm going to build this up because that this is very, a very dense picture. So I'm going to start with the common case. So remember, we're caching files and program data. So how can we access program data and files? Well, there's two ways. We can access program data using a virtual address. A program accesses a virtual address, and the CPU uses the page table to figure out where the cache copy of that is. And this is our cache hit case. Now, for reading files, well, we're going to call read or write. And in the scheme, the way read or write are going to work is that they're not going to actually just access the disk. They're going to look up in an OS data structure for a cache copy of the file and find where that is in memory and access and figure out how to access the actual physical memory that holds that cache copy rather than going to disk. So we have these two different data structures that are being used in this hit case, the case where, you know, yes, the data really belongs on disk, but we're actually accessing the fast cache version. So our page table, we've seen the structure of, and this is something where OSs really don't have much flexibility. The hardware is reading the page table. The OS doesn't get to decide what it looks like. For the file read and write, the OS has more choices because the OS made this data structure. It's the only one using it. It can use whatever it likes. And I guess something worth noting is that this is also a data structure we're using on a page fault for mmap memory. So sometimes something won't be in the page table, but it will be in this data structure, in which case, you know, sort of it will be filled in on a page fault. But in either case, what we basically need is we need to know here's a file and here's an offset, which we could have gotten from read, knowing, oh, we're 100 bytes into the file, or from a page fault, knowing, oh, the program called mmap earlier, this is the part of the file that's there, and need to look that up and figure out where it is in memory, if it is. And one way you could manage this, which is and what Linux does roughly, is you could have a balanced tree for every file, for example, and look up a particular index and offset in that tree. So questions about our cache hit case. So we have this kernel data structure that's maintaining. Can I explain the mmap part again? So we mentioned earlier that that sometimes we won't set up the whole page table in advance, but we'll know that part of the file is mapped. So in that case, if we think about our diagram here, there's going to be a miss on this access that the CPU is going to use, but we're going to be able to handle that miss by looking up in this data structure, that the OS will have sort of this picture, the page table like might not have everything filled in, but we'll be able to do the lookup of this data structure to figure out how to fill in the page table. And okay. So this is the cache hit case, but then we need to consider, well, what's going to happen if, you know, we have a page fault and we look up where the data should actually be and we find out, well, it doesn't really belong. We don't have a copy of it yet. We need to get it from disk. What's our process for loading it from disk? And there's an important first step that we're going to talk about later, which is that we need to free up a page, that we need somewhere to put the data, and presumably, well, not presumably, but often, you know, we'll have to choose a page to evict. We'll have to get rid of some data that's useful. We'll talk about that later. Because if we think of, you know, having all our files, we'll run out of memory eventually. We'll need to free up some space. The easy case is maybe we have some free memory already. And after we've chosen where to put the data, we need to load it. And we need to know where it is. So we're going to look at that issue. So we need to have a way of finding the location on disk. So we're going to have some way of going from a virtual address to a location on disk, or from a file and offset to a location on disk. So the file and offset, well, we're going to talk about file systems later. We'll talk about exactly how this works. And then we have to go from a virtual address to a location on disk. And there's typically two ways this works. So in Linux, there's like two cases for this. So one case is that this data structure basically points to the file system data structure where we have part of an mmapped file. So basically we just have something that points to the file, you know, the location lookup. And if we have something that's swapped out, Linux tracks this separately from the file system. But either way, we need some way of going from a virtual address to a location on disk so we know where to actually look up the data. And I mentioned that Linux tracks a file as mmapped regions. So basically in Linux, each of these lines of the output I showed is a struct that has, you know, a pointer to the file. So we can look things up and figure out where that location is. So we can actually find the data on disk. Okay. So it might seem like, well, I've explained all the data structures we actually need to, you know, manage our page cache, but there's an important thing we're missing, which has to do with this idea of evicting pages, that when we bring something in from disk, we need sometimes to remove something else to make room. And this is going to require some way of clearing this part of the data structure. Right, because we have entries for the page we're replacing in these two data structures, and we need to get rid of them. So we're going to need to update page tables, because if we have a victim page, this is the page that we're removing from memory to make room for something else, well, it needs to get out of the page tables. It also needs to get out of the OS data structures that, you know, contain a list of what pages of a file are cached. And this means that we're usually going to have some way of going from a physical page here. We're going to choose a physical page that we want to take out of memory and put it on disk. But to do this, well, we need to figure out where does it go on disk. And commonly, we're going to have some sort of data structure that's going to let us locate that location. So we'll have a data structure that does the page to what file is this part of, and a data structure that does the page to where does the program have it in its page table, so we can update the mappings in the other direction to handle us removing the page. Questions about why we need these reverse mappings? So question is, why evict physical pages instead of virtual pages? Well, the physical page is what we want to allocate, is the space we want to allocate, and it could have multiple virtual addresses, and we need to take care of all of them. So if a program, for example, if two programs have the same file mapped, there's going to be two virtual addresses for the page. We need to find all of them. So commonly OSs, we're going to have a data structure like for each physical page with pointers to what file is this a part of, what programs have this mapped, so they can do this eviction process. So question, this is a lot of info, there isn't a suggested reading on the schedule page. I should update the suggested readings. They probably should be the readings from a previous day, should be go to today. Is what most likely what happened is I expected to cover this earlier and the readings for a previous day are the readings on this. But I will update the suggested reading after this lecture. It would be the section of the textbook, either of the textbooks on virtual memory, most likely, will cover this. Okay. So one other thing we're going to need is we need some way of choosing what page to allocate. And, you know, we could just choose a random page to replace, but we want to make an intelligent choice. We want to choose something that is likely not being used much. So we're actually going to have this other data structure where for every physical page that we might want to load something into, we're going to track, is this actually being used right now? So we can do an intelligent choice when we need to load something. And this idea of figuring out what page to evict is commonly known as page replacement. So page replacement, you know, is that we're going to want to, you know, make a good choice here of what page we're actually going to send back to disk so we can make room for something that needs to be loaded from disk. And there's a number of goals you could imagine having, kind of like scheduling. It's a very similar problem. We have a choice to make about what page do we, you know, in this case, hurt. And there's different goals that you could have. And, you know, so you could have like a throughput or a fairness goal, kind of like our example of processor scheduling. We're going to talk about how we can optimize hit rate. So hit rate is the number of misses. Misses mean we'd have to load something from disk. We're going to talk about how we optimize the hit rate. How we maximize the number of times we look for something in memory. So we look for something in our page cache and it's actually in memory rather than needing to be loaded from disk. And you might say, well, isn't that the same as maximizing performance and minimizing overhead? Kind of. It's close. But there are cases where this doesn't quite agree. So for example, if we're allocating a page of the heap on demand versus reading something from disk, you know, that's a very different speed. Like writing a page of zeros is much faster than, you know, reading data from disk. Some pages to take them out of memory, we might be able to just throw them away because we already have a copy on disk, say if it's a copy of data that's already in a file. Other cases, we might need to write to disk and that would be much slower. So we're going to ignore this for now, but in a real OS, these might all be concerns which would affect what page you choose. We're just going to assume that we only care about maximizing the number of hits, and therefore we're kind of assuming that every time we have to, you know, take out a page, it costs the same, even though that's not really true. Another thing we're going to ignore when we talk about optimizing hit rate is we're going to ignore one way of optimizing hit rate that real OSs do. That's kind of a bonus thing you can do on top of another eviction strategy. And this is where we can read ahead. So if you think of the examples I showed when we had that counting exercise, you know, we had this idea that the program was accessing page 1.3, 1.4, and 1.5, and each of those would require a page fault. And, you know, if not everything was cached, you know, we'd have to read from disk when that page fault happened. So something you might say is, maybe when the program accesses page 1.3, we should make sure page 1.4 is in the cache, you know, because maybe the program is going to need it. And this is something OSs really do, is that they actually bring in stuff in advance. They read ahead of where the program is, guessing what the program's going to do. They might guess wrong, but when they guess right, it's a lot faster. So this is something we're not going to talk about very much, but I want you to be aware it's something OSs do. So we're going to assume we're not doing any of this sort of guessing what the program's going to do. We're going to say, how can we optimize the hit rate? So only bringing in things on demand. We're not going to read in advance. We're not going to guess what the program's going to access. And read something before the program actually needs it. And we're going to maximize the hits. Now, so if you do this, there's a possible best algorithm for what page do we choose to evict. And this is called Belady's Min. And in Belady's Min, we read the page that's accessed furthest in the future. Now, you might notice a problem here that I just talked about how we guess what the program does, and it seems like this algorithm requires not guessing what the program does, but knowing what the program does. So we can't actually implement this, but we're going to use this as an example because, you know, if we could figure out what the program is going to access furthest in the future, this is going to give us the best possible performance. And we're going to have practical algorithms which don't require predicting the future, which are going to give us, you know, close to this performance, and we'll be able to see like how good they are by comparing to this best possible. So a question, why not furthest in the past instead of furthest in the future? So we'll look at an example which will hopefully make it clearer, but furthest in the future is because the sort of intuition is that we want to make it take the longest time until we need a replacement. So I'll go through an example here. So here I have three physical pages, and here are the virtual pages I've accessed, and I'm numbering the virtual, lettering the virtual pages to make them distinct from the physical pages, but you could imagine these would be different virtual addresses that program, some program is accessing in this order. And when the program accesses page D, well, we need to choose something to bring in because we only have three physical pages to use. And I have different choices. And Belady's Min would say I choose to replace C. And why do I do that? Well, because that allows me to delay having something else replaced for the longest time. Because since C is furthest in the future, this means that these next three accesses won't need replacement. If I chose B, only the next two wouldn't need a replacement. If I chose A, you know, the next zero wouldn't need a replacement. So this is maximizing the number of accesses I can have before I need the next replacement. And sort of that's why this is optimal. So because we've done that, we have these three accesses happen without us needing any replacement, but then we get to C, which was the best we could have done, and C needs to replace something. And here, with the information given, well, A and D are equally good candidates. We don't want to replace B because, you know, we know that that's the next thing that's going to be accessed, so that would be, you know, not actually useful. So questions on what this policy looks like. So the question is, shouldn't we have some sort of tiebreaker between these? That is something we could imagine doing, but it's not part of Belady's Min. So, since we have Min, let's do here. What should the access to D replace? Another 30 seconds. Okay, so most of you have selected C. And C allows us to avoid replacing anything for 1, 2, 3, 4 time units. Second most popular answer is A. A is pretty good, but it only allows us to avoid replacing something for 3 time units instead of 4. So that means that our best answer here is going to be replacing C. So D goes here. And this works until we access C again. So then question is, what should the access to C replace? Give 30 seconds for this because based on previous answer, this should be quick. Okay, and we have pretty good consensus that it's B, and I agree because we never access B again. Okay. So this algorithm works, but we have this problem that we kind of need to look in the future, and we can't actually do that. So what is a practical solution? So what is something we can actually do? And the way we're going to have a practical solution is we're going to make some assumption about what future accesses look like. And our assumption is going to be about temporal locality, that things that are accessed now will be accessed again soon. And if we have this assumption, this gives us sort of two policies that sort of naturally arise from this assumption, you know, are going to be actually possible to implement. And the one we're going to talk about is least recently used, that the thing we want to replace is something that wasn't accessed recently, because under this assumption, the things that were accessed recently will be accessed soon, and the things that weren't, well, we don't have any reason to believe they'll be accessed soon. So least recently used is it's an implementable policy. We'll learn it's not the real policy we're going to use, mainly because even though we can implement it, it's not actually practical. But we'll do something like least recently used. And, you know, in the common case, you know, it works out pretty well. So here, for example, for least recently used, so I need to decide what to replace, have D replace, and well, the least recently used thing is C, because C was last accessed 1, 2, 3 time units ago. B was last accessed 1. A was accessed 2. C is our winner, probably really our loser. And we replace C, and then we have another access here. We need to bring back C. And if we look at what was accessed longest ago, that's going to be A, because B and D are both sooner. Now, least recently used sort of doesn't always achieve the optimum. And this is because we're making that assumption. We're making this locality assumption, and that's not always true. So here, I have a pattern which has very poor temporal locality because, you know, when are we going to access C again? You know, not soon relative to when we're going to access everything else. So if we do LRU for this, we get 8 replacements versus 3 replacements if we use Belady's min. Okay. So next time we'll look a little more at practicing what least recently used does, and we'll talk about sort of how we can actually practically do something like least recently used and why we can't really do exact least recently used in an OS's page cache. That's where I'll leave off today. I'll take questions before I sign off.
Yeah, I just have a quick question on the homework test case.
Okay.
So on the alloc large then fork, Getting a fail, it's saying like parts of the allocation are using the wrong value, but it says everything in the parent worked fine. I'm not really sure like what might be causing that. Do you think maybe it's like the child's page table's not being copied correctly? But
so
I checked my copy UVM and it seemed fine.
So you change copy UVM. So what, once this thing I'd be suspicious of is whether the copy UVM is working. The other I'd be suspicious of is whether if you're, are you doing any part of copy on write?
No.
Okay. So you're actually copying the pages.
Yeah.
Okay. So they actually have independent paid copies. I would, yeah. So it would be hard for deallocation to be broken. But if they were shared, deallocation would be a big concern. Because if you accidentally deallocated something that was shared, that would be bad. It was still being shared, I should say. So I'm not sure. So my sort of first debugging step would be to look carefully at, like, see if it, if you can reproduce it with a smaller version of the alloc large test. Like, if you lower the numbers, if it still happens,
okay.
And then
it worked totally fine on the five tries one. It seems almost exactly the same, but it's five tries, which is kind of weird.
So, but the difference between the two is the alloc then fork forks with a lot of memory allocated. The other one only allocates memory after forking.
Oh, okay. So it is probably copy UVM then.
So yeah, copy UVM is different. I could imagine it being some rare problem where you're like inadvertently freeing something you're not supposed to. That just doesn't come up all the time.
And should I revise dealloc UVM? It seemed like it was fine with the way I changed the code, but should I actually go in there and like make sure that it doesn't deallocate something that, like, say I allocated a heap but I didn't use any of it and then I deallocated it? That wouldn't cause a problem, right?
So dealloc UVM like calls K free.
Okay.
And doesn't, does it check whether it's allocated? That's.
I think it does. It checks like, it checks like if it was actually allocated. If it's not, then it just returns out.
Okay, so if it checks whether it's allocated, that would be fine. But if it didn't, that would be a problem, or if it didn't do it correctly. So something else, something I watch out for then is so, I'd be worried about is whether you're corrupting the list of free pages somehow. Like by freeing something that you're not supposed to.
Okay. Cool.
So that's something you can check for how you're using K-free.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions?